This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. We are headed into another fine evening of poetry. My first guest tonight is Sidney Lee, L-E-A. He is a Vermont poet. As a matter of fact, in 2011, he was named the Poet Laureate of Vermont. Tonight, he'll be reading from his 11th collection of poems, I Was Thinking of Beauty, which is available now from Four Way Books. He is a prolific writer and is known in several genres. He founded the New England Review in 1977 and edited it until 1989. Of his previous poetry collections, Pursuit of a Wound, which was published by University of Illinois Press in 2000, was one of three finalists for the Pulitzer Prize for Poetry. No easy feat. And To the Bone, New and Selected Poems, was a co-winner of the 1998 Poets Prize. Lee has been described as a man in the woods with his head full of books and a man in books with his head full of woods. He has a very strong affinity to nature. So let's turn now to Sidney as he reads from his latest collection. This was recorded in Boston in March of 2013.
I'll be reading from a book that is due in April called I Was Thinking of Beauty. It's my 11th collection of poetry. And everything that I read here is from that volume. And the first poem was called Fathomless. I remember that store and the nasty redneck whose stink seemed a challenge to everyone in it. The scene is decades old, but I'm still confused that no one took up the challenge, including me, though I liked an occasional fight back then. Prospect of pain meant less to me once, I guess. An aneurysm had just killed my brother, so the pain I'm talking about was my body's. I breathed up another pain that day. I checked the man's beep pickup. Why would he want them, those skunks, knee-deep in its bed? I left the lot, still more confused, my sweet retriever shivering on the seat beside me. The god-awful smell still clung to the dog's wet coat and my own. There'd be no more hikes for us that morning. Rain had arrived, bone-chilling. If you killed a skunk, why would you keep the thing? To kill some time, I stopped at the Jackpot View. We've always called it that. Five mountaintops bled into mists to my east in New Hampshire. The sudden squall spilled leaves on the woods floor's pall of nondescript hue. Now he was dead. Now my brother was dead. I can't define any guy, but only this morning I caught a whiff of road-killed skunk and thought I could speak of him or it or her as surely as I could tell you the slightest thing concerning the man I'm remembering now, the one who shot or trapped or clubbed those miserable, reeking creatures. The smallest enigmas we ever encounter remain as hard to explain as all the epical ones. I've failed for years to fathom the death of my brother. But it's just as hard to understand why a scene in an old Vermont store should linger like dead skunk odor, which, if you've lately been tainted, come back to scent you whenever a rain blows in. Or like some pains you may have thought you'd long since gotten over, but which, at some odd prompting, come back to haunt you. This poem was written in anticipation of the last of my five children leaving the nest and going off to college. It's called To a Young Father. This riverbend must have always been lovely. Take the one-lane iron bridge shortcut across the town's west end and look downstream to where the water backs up by the falls. Boys once fished there with butterball bait because the creamery churned by hydro, and the trout were so rich, says my ancient neighbor, they tasted like heaven, only better. Try to stop on the bridge if no one's coming to see the back of the furniture mill in upside-down detail on the river, assuming the day is clear and still. I've lived here and driven this road forever. Strange, therefore, that I've never taken the same advice I'm offering you. I've lived here, but I've too often been racing to get to work or else back home to my wife and our younger school-aged children, the fifth and last of whom will be headed away to college starting this autumn. I hope I paid enough attention to her and the others in spite of the lawn, the plowing, the bills, the urgent concerns of career and upkeep. Soon she'll be gone. Try to stop on the bridge in fall. That is when hardwood trees by the river drop carmine and amber onto the surface. Or in spring when the foliage has gotten no bigger than any newborn infant's ear, such that the light from sky to stream makes the world, as I've said, or at least this corner, complete, in fact double. I'd never have dreamed a household entirely empty of children. It'll be the first time in decades, which may mean depression and, if so, indifference to the river's reflections, the leaves and shades, but more likely, like you, if you shrug off my counsel, or even take it, it'll be through tears that I witness each of these things, so lovely. They must have been lovely all these years. This is a poem called You Listen to Dexter Gordon. Dexter Gordon, a great jazz saxophonist, a star of a movie called Round Midnight, and an idol of mine when I was a young man. I wanted to be able to play the sax like him, but lack of talent got in the way. You listen to Dexter Gordon. Miss X was gentle. She helped you climb the staff, those lines on which hung EGBDF. Every good boy does fine, she told you, smiling, to remind you which note went where, and perhaps to soothe you. But there'd be more climbing, and you knew you'd never make it, you fat little stupid oaf. You would drop piano. Two clefs were too much. You never learned the bass, and life seemed already overcomplicated. Kind X, goodbye. You took up with Mr. Y. By now it wasn't the notes that exasperated, but you couldn't manage to make your fingers function so the sax could soar into song. The squawks, the broken reeds, your breaking soul when Y named you shit for brains and when he claimed he might as well be talking to a wall. Maybe a mother could love you, but I can't stand you. You'll admit you didn't ever practice much, though you weren't lazy no matter the things he yelled. Laziness figured in less than plain awareness. You'd never be Dexter Gordon, or much at all. Home meant discord and drink, so Y was wrong about mother love. Because you could have practiced your scales and whatever else might be expected until, cliché leaps in, you went blue in the face. You'd be what she said you were. A lifetime later, Dexter whispers his way through Don't Explain. You want to explain nonetheless. You bring to mind the easy trick of the easy piano teacher for the gaps between the lines. F-A-C-E, she said. Your face is all you have to remember. Then touched your cheek, which, though no practice had blued. You were already blue enough when you listened to Y, or ached for some girl from what seemed unbreachable distance, or heard the household's silences, mutters, roars. Dexter moves on to Guess I'll Hang My Tears Out to Dry, and you breathe, Every Good Boy Does Fine. You should have paid attention to Sweet Miss X, because weren't you good? You wanted to be, at least, though even you couldn't stand the sight in the mirror before you climbed into bed of your own face. This poem is called Dead Farms, and it sort of speaks of a generation between the real old country people and their grandkids. There's an in-between generation with sort of deracinated, many of them Vietnam vets. Dead Farms, Caledonia County, 2011. Vainest snapshots of Dad before he went over. The photographs have sat on small tables so long that the sons can't even see them. In the dark of their trailers, from the black and whites, the sons would have to imagine corn silks yellow, roof metal bleeding orange, red granite gateposts, glints of mica in fieldstone. But the sons aren't a sort to imagine. Their fathers chose, or was it their women who chose, each picture's background, shed and tractor, garden, wellhead, plow. Breeze lifts the farmer's hair. They're never indoors. Each smokes or holds his favorite brand of smoke. Lucky, Camel, Chesterfield, Who cares? Say he survived tobacco and bullet and bomb. Things change, he's gone. But women has always looked to the laundry and housework. Enlisting mobile homes, they make the worlds of absent men go round, scraping up suppers that often wait in a pan on a cooling back burner. Among these uprooted sons are a miserable few who madden themselves with curses on wife or girlfriend. They went off to Vietnam and are wards now, field dirt dumb, reviling their nurses. Murder makes the odd headline, more commonly beatings. Was it always like this? Will it be? In their own sons' heads, will women conspire, all of them bent on cheating male partners blind by inscrutable female cunning? But what could be robbed from such men? Their pickups, their dead-end piecework jobs, their bar stools, they'd say, well, something. But they aren't a sort to say something. A world of wars jets through their veins, and the batterer's own framed pictures, you'll notice more often than not that they're carrying arms, propping their feet on the chest of a kill in autumn. It's a buck, it's never a doe, which might leave you bewildered unless you were versed in what's left of deer camp tradition. Sad remnants their boys will inherit, while women still pour nurture on all these farmers' heirs who'll crave it and hate it. Is war the appropriate metaphor? There could be others, no doubt, like seeds with surfeit of nourishment, whose fruit can never quite sweeten. Extravagant vines will smother, or else will turn it so bitter it leaves the one who tastes it weeping. I'm just old enough that my dad and all his friends were in World War II when I was very young, but I do have some vivid memories because I was lucky enough to live in a house full of women. My mother, my grandmother, two aunts, first cousin who was 15 or so, and I was spoiled completely and delightfully. House of women. The last of that war is all fragment, vignette at best. He's barely three. The house houses nothing but women. Mothers and grandmothers, cousins and aunts, the husbands in Europe or Asia, and what the women call theater. There's theater here, he believes. But how can he know such a concept, having never seen play nor film, and television unheard of? He crouches in the curtain knee-hole of Aunt Faye's vanity table as she daubs on morning makeup. He parts the cloth as if for a show, which it is, and seated so, Faye looks lovely. She's always lovely, and it's not cosmetics that make her a beautiful lady. It's her polio-withered leg that causes the lurch when she rises, but the lurch is part of the drama, the beauty. All done, she sighs. She kills the light and sips a taste of something and tells him not to tell. He won't. She puffs at a cigarette and sighs. Perhaps she misses the deadbeat Uncle Nick, who isn't that yet, the deadbeat. He's living somewhere on a ship. The boy doesn't care. Their daughter Nancy's 15 and flirts with him, though flirt is another word he can't yet command. Her kisses are simply sweets from the stores of the women, limitless, warm. The sun stands theatrically low, the summer lawn gone dark when the stranger appears, burly and strapping in khaki. He has nerve enough to dash right up the drive and into the house as if he owned it. The child at the nursery window upstairs stands watch in shock, the end of the world so near. He's sick with terror. Meanwhile, the high-heeled shoes of his frenzied mother go avalanching downstairs despite his howls. The impostor lifts and swings her round and round till Earth must seem as distant to her as a star. His own days of stardom are over. Peaceable Kingdom. Doesn't everyone dream of heaven? After quarrel, he wishes his own could land at his feet. He's on foot. As he passes the round Shaker Barn on Route 7 on an April afternoon of what's called unseasonable heat, his eyes alight on two ravens, crisp contours obscured by the asphalt's shimmer. They gorge on a flattened hair. Winter pallor vanished but for some streaks in the clotted fur. In heaven, he reasons, there is no loss, no accident. Everything knows its way. The carnivores lie down with the herbivores. It's a famous claim. By extension, no snowshoe hare ever strays into traffic. Or if it does, it rises, and raptors feed on seeds, and a wife and husband never battle, and Pharaoh's armies all have long since drowned, each soldier rolling up and back in the ocean's rote, his eyes rimed innocent white with salt. Abattoir time. The widower pushed the tailgate shut and fell. The two sounds, click and thud, seemed synchrony, as if one in fact were function of the other. The red calf, bound for veal in the pickup's bed, looked rearward over his shoulder. No one there. A ginger-hackled rooster, framed by the door of the loft, screamed loudly, sun igniting him to noontime flame. He sent six hens in a dash for cover under bush and sill, as though his love assault might be a thing far worse than the farmer felt. Or rather did not feel. The death so quick and commotionless his livestock didn't notice. Everything once had purpose here, he told me, and meaning, and might still have if only he'd stayed to read them. Now a skinny cloud rode unremarked on a breeze above the barn, unsafe and leaning. His horse, a spavined relic from other ages, whickered behind the house, all canted too, its paint mere scattered flakes. Meaning and purpose had blurred in recent years, but the farmer kept right after them, no matter. Who'd free the weanling now? Who lead him to slaughter? Ars Vitae, for Ted Leeson. All I've said, I made it up, including the things that really happened. Outside my window now, above the autumn pond I've conjured, two dapper kingfishers start to flit as I dream them. And in morning fog, the trees of October show brightly, because just now I've imagined a sun so sharp it could make you bleed. Once, think of the number. Seven life otters led me and my brother downstream as we two fished the mighty Missouri. That's the memory of Montana, which is not a place, as I'm reminded by a favorite Western writer, but the name of a place. There are dogs I've treasured, quick and lost, and horses and songs and people living and gone, although in fact they're only what I've concocted from a life of talk. And yet whatever I've talked about is fact. It must be true, or else I only had some maps. I had no place, nor did I know old woodsmen or their stories, to choose an example, but only read a book or two. I had nothing. I never knew a soul, a thing. I made up the eagle I saw today as he stooped to the neck of a Canada goose. I made up the goose which collapsed at the river's edge, which I also devised. She fell close by, as dead as if I'd shot her myself as I paddled. I intended to stop and watch that eagle, whose tail still showed dark stripes, which means I'd made him into a young one. I'd stop with an eye to beholding another dive from a blighted elm that leaned at what I'd construed as just the proper angle. But I kept on moving northward, fabricating the umber and mauve leaves that floated upriver, counter to reason, beside my gliding wisp of canoe. I invented the leaves so I could conceive that backwash of eddy and feel it move me, like many of my visions, including those of things that really happened, as if my up were down, and my progress that fluent, easy, at least for moments. The Villanelle called Small Jeremiad. I killed a catbird once when I was young. I'd still insist I didn't really mean to. Just noticed him and flung a thoughtless stone. I've done much worse. So why would this live on? My cracked LP is Mulligan Meets Getz. I killed a catbird once when I was young. But why, awake at dawn, should I have turned from husky saxes intoning that old feeling to some poor bird at whom I flung a stone? My thoughts oblique. A catbird flew to our lawn as I chose the record, a vestigial, unusual thing, like the bird in my part of New England. I cast no stone, yet I'm sunk in lamentation, things I have done, ones I have left undone. There's that old feeling. I killed a catbird once when I was young. My life's the only life I'll ever own. I own it all when memory wings in. I killed a catbird once when I was young. Just noticed him and flung a thoughtless stone. The Gray Museum. Flat on their tapestry, hawks and hounds and a corps of horsemen showed that much flatter for the sleeted windows. All of Manhattan seemed a great gray museum. Our words went blurry. It was never romance, or do you insist? I thought how mountains sag into deltas with time. From a sill outside, drab pigeons flushed into haze and were erased. The horseman's woven reins went slack. In a hotel bed later that night, even sleep turned gray. In my dream, a train that huffed till the station misted like glass. In yours, you reported fog to coastal Maine. To me, your report proved unintriguing. I know you'd never seen that shore. Our breakfast eggs looked hueless, yolkless. Attempted speech bleared in our mouths, and the morning newspaper faded, smearing the sodden pulp it faded into. I haven't thought in years of that day, so little to draw me back to then. You wouldn't know me, grown vivid and colorful. And you, you've leached away. So what, you might ask, is bringing this on? And how could you ask? What would I say? Hum and click. The puppy softly whined in dream, as if she heard that subtle clicking mixed with a hum, which seemed to come from some electric device. Then she quieted. Inertia of summer's night had settled on him as well, soft as bed linen. How often he'd stood at a window, shining a flashlight outdoors, but never determined the source of that sound, so odd and confounding. After so many failures, he barely pulled himself again from mattress to floor and down the bowed-in upstairs hall to see what little he would. The song, to call it that, rose out of the rough, abandoned field uphill from the house. I need to know what it is for certain, he thought. He might. The moon gleamed full, and he was only 27. In the shine, at last, miraculous, a hen whippoorwill who picked at gravel while the cock, in full strut with tail up thrust, hummed and clicked a small bird's version of immemorial courtship rites common to all us earthly creatures. How pretty she was, his sleeping wife. And tomorrow, he reckoned, I'll know forever something I didn't know tonight. Succeeding owners all renovate parts of the house, on which that evening moon drops softly, however bright. These years along in more lasting marriage, some of his children now have children. He's owned just under a dozen dogs since he heard the whine from that puppy pointer at whippoorwills, which hereabouts have grown so rare he'd almost surrender years of his life just to hear one now. Thaw. When he fetched the morning paper, he read of the would-be bomber wrestled down by a fellow traveler. A mile in the air, but nothing exploded. The man merely scorched his own shins. Here, icicles fall and bleed on the ground. His roof metal pings, day yawns. He He yawns at a crossword. 22 down. Rams, ma'am. Tired clue for you. It baffled him once, which seems hard to imagine. He feels as though the years since then, as soon as they get here, vanish. An expert now, he needs no pencil. Taps his pen on the puzzle. Gray grainy grid on the page. Below the fold, Hollywood buzzes with something or other. He doesn't buzz. If he used to have a life beyond a hobby, a dog on his lap, is this one so vapid he craves explosion? No, and he knows it. But as trees go grainy and gray as well with something vague, neither rain nor snow, they iterate the world's sad flatness of feature. 19 down, ovum to be. His children are gone, his wife in the earth, who even in older age could be ardent. And all around him, a rampancy of things lukewarm and wizened. Maybe terror is you, he puns, the you that's not Ram's man, nor is he Ram anymore. He sluggishly seeks a synonym for chat in seven letters, 16 across. Now he needs his wife to be back, needing her ear for his desolate whispers, whimpers. The dear deaf dachshund breathes on him from cheek to chin. It quickens him for a moment, that heady, delusive mixture, animal heat and animal moisture. This is the title poem of the book from which I have been reading. I Was Thinking of Beauty. It refers to the great jazz composer, the great and volatile jazz composer, Charles Mingus. I surrendered myself to Mingus's Tijuana moods on my obsolete record machine, sitting quiet as I sat last night. I was thinking of beauty then, how it's faced grief since the day that somebody named it. Plato, Aquinas, the grim rock tablets that were handed down to Moses by Yahweh, with his famous stricture on the graven image. Last evening I was there when some noted professor in a campus town to southward addressed what he called, precisely, the issue of beauty. Here was a person who seemed to believe his learned jargon might help the poor because his lecture would help to put an end to the exploitations of capitalism, which pays his wage at the Ivy College, through which he leads the impressionable young, soon to be managers, brokers, bankers. He was hard above all on poems, though after a brief appearance, poetry seemed to vanish. It was gone before I knew it. The professor quoted, "Beauty is truth, truth beauty," then chuckled. He explained that such a claim led to loathsome politics. I'm afraid he lost me. Outside, the incandescent snow of February sifted through the quad's tall elm trees, hypnotic. Tonight, as I sit alone and listen, the trumpet on Tijuana gift shop lurches my heart with its syncopations. That's the rare Clarence Shaw, who vanished one day, though Mingus heard he was teaching hypnosis somewhere. But back again to last evening. I got thinking of Keats composing and coughing, of Abby Lincoln, of Lorrain and Petrarch, of Callas and Isaac Stern. I was lost in memory and delight, terms without doubt nostalgic. I summoned a dead logger friend's description of cedar waxwings on the bright mountain ash outside his door come middle autumn. I remembered how Earl at 90 had called those verdigris birds well-groomed little folks, which wasn't eloquent, no, but what passion showed in the way Earl waved his work-worn hands as he thought of beauty which, according to our guest, was opiate. Perhaps. And yet I went on for no reason to consider Maori tattoos elaborate and splendid, Jamaicans shaping Big Oil's rusty abandoned barrels to play on with makeshift mallets, toxic junk turning tuneful. "The poor you have always with you," said an even more famous speaker. Supreme narcotic dealer, no doubt, in our speaker's eyes. Eyes that must never once have paused to behold a bird. Ears that deafened themselves to the song of that bird or any. No, beauty's a drug, he insisted, from which we must wean the poor, indeed must wean ourselves. But I was thinking of beauty as something that will return. Here's Curtis Porter's Sweet Horn, outlasting our disputations. I was thinking it never had gone.
This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. You have been listening to Vermont poet Sidney Lee, L-E-A, reading from his latest collection of poems, I Was Thinking of Beauty. If you would like to learn more about Sidney Lee and his many collections of poetry, you can go to sidneylee.net. That's SYDNEYLEA.net. Now, on that same March evening in Boston, when I recorded Sidney Lee reading, I also recorded another poet, Mark Irwin. He came in late that night. It was a dastardly day weather-wise, but he made it through a pretty wicked blizzard to record this. He is the author of 7 collections of poetry, including Against the Meanwhile, Wesleyan University Press, Quick Now Always, BOA, White City, BOA, Bright Hunger, also BOA, Tall If, New Issues, and his most recent collection, Large White House Speaking, which was published by New Issues this year. He has also translated 2 volumes of poetry, one from the French and one from Romanian. His American Urn, New and Selected Poems, will appear in 2014. Mark Irwin lives in Colorado and Los Angeles, where he teaches in the PhD in Creative Writing and Literature program at the University of Southern California. Let's move on now to Mark Irwin.
So, my name is Mark Irwin, and I'm going to read from my 7th book, which was just published by New Issues. It's called Large White House Speaking. And I think I'd like to start with the epigraph by the American poet Charles Wright. 2 lines from his long poem, Littlefoot. The line between heaven and earth is a grass blade, a light green and hard to walk. The first poem I'll read is entitled Ghost. Now your name's just a guest here, one that cancels all hellos. Fleshless, you come and go through the mansion of air. How will I address you, small weather? Sometimes your name's a dress like an iron bell the years swing shadows from longer than home. Can you hear that word peal? I'm going there now, carrying the windows from inside all the vowels. Red feather. This red feather floating down from the canopy of a tree, the one we watch all of our lives, then remember as so many other breathing things. Caught in a jar, the tadpoles slowly lost their gills and tails to become fat, knuckly, green. What future tense to describe them then? What grammar I still look for, dissolving in dissolving past. The owl blinks its glass eyes in a tree. Sometimes I think the red feathers the word is. I crack the skull of an egg and watch the albumen whiten in a hot pan. Look, someone's carrying red feathers into a church, where they grow into a choir of blowing mouths. My father once said that all our lives we travel between the towns of yes and no. I hesitated, smiled, then walked into a sun-ripe woods. Red feather, we enter bodies, then place them in the earth or flame. April now, and the frogs crawl up through the mud to sing. This poem, the title becomes part of the first line. When I see this x-ray of a hand's long, jointed bones, floating like a bird's, prehistoric, knuckling in their brightness, as if to perform some magic trick, to pull a kerchief from the debut of darkness. I feel dangerous as a spy, though unwilling, as that reach towards something between milk and sorrow, yet a gift, though be it a knife, slow like times, then I feel myself straining, listening to the long echo of flesh say hello. What you might say of Christ. At the junction between gnat and God, he came from grief to make a city named Marvel. The milk words he spoke turned adults to children, their minds vivid as with the scent of bananas. Beyond body, trees ushered dusk purples fast and silent. Censers gilded through centuries like the immensity of a minute, wherein the bee trundles from the pollen-crowned stamen against the spathe's white arena. Hungry. I'm hungry for the leaves, their ochre and blaze, hungry for their evening and the sun's hammer, hungry for the dusk filled with musty scent of apple and grape, hungry for the trill of crickets and for the first stars. So hungry I drive a stake into the ground for each one and grow hungrier as it grows darker. I'm hungry for the constellations, for that one striding like an ithiosar across the night sky. Hungry for the pitch black above, which reminds me of words, their names for things beyond what they are, and for the feelings they carry on which I gorge. This next poem is entitled Rider, R-I-D-E-R. As I carried my mother from the hospital bed across the room toward the chair by the window, she played with my gold watch as if it were a toy, flipping the strap up and down, then singing, "Giddy up, giddy up." But as I looked at her, she did not smile, so I nodded my head, snorted, then put a pencil in my mouth as bit and cantered about the room till I was out of breath, puffing. And she patted me, saying, "Good boy, good boy." So I pawed the carpet, slobbering a little like her, as she waved, and I nodded my mane, until this was how we said goodbye one spring, while the sun shrank to a white-hot BB among a thousand others, receding in the jeweled black sky as the rivers galloped away with her breath through the dark green land. Church engine. Speech crumbling through emotion. This hole we tear in the world with our bodies. We could see tomorrow's infant reaching hands. What can be known, really? The way you push me up and pull me down from sleep. Bone, muscle, fascia, skin. We tried to write what we heard. No one was speaking. Drone of radio, TV. Are you connected? By a stoplight, a man on his knees. "Please," he said. Behind that word, a shelf. Then nothing. Cars leaving the walls of a city. Without a map, we begin singing. April. The 5 o'clock LA skies, alive with jets and palms, swimming in a cocktail of smog. In the attic yesterday, I found your helmet. It's dull red, scratched and dusty in the dormer's blast of sun. You held me once as we slid down a brassy pole and stepped onto the fire truck, shiny as a dream toy. Dead 50 years now. You drank a glass of milk each night before bed. A green willow brushes against the window, while a hummingbird rams its breast into a pyracantha blossom. In London once, I touched a bronze Corinthian helmet whose pitted crown was dented from blows. And here's your watch, too, dumb and stalled, but yearning in the skies blown gold. This poem is entitled Paperclip. It was the paperclip on the sidewalk, attached to and attaching nothing, made me want to change, to dial up a family, tell them I'd be home for dinner soon, to sit by the hearth and speak of change, a chimney that would vent all fires, in a tinsel bag to hold the seconds spun from years. What smarts is the smile time pulls across our bodies, a new geography waiting to be explored by the quick eyes of youth, just as your eyes once held me in a future's arms. Yes, I admit that I love the body, but it's that other diamonded hook within our flesh that pulls us toward a hook of many hooks, shining so brightly no one can see, only feel. The pulling, a kind of family beyond all belief. This poem's title is Tell Me, and it also runs into the first line of the poem. Tell me, if you know, how we hear music in silence or a dead person's voice in our minds, that child's swing blown back and forth, or in a glass case, the axe kept in a bag of feathers, the one we carry in our sleep, the one whose blade shines like the back of a watch. Stopping by the river in spring, far from snow dissolving, this river marked no trespassing by the shore where I linger in lingering daylight, waked by the water's rash white voyage, rags that tear the light farther into the pines. There's feathers darkening above this quiring, insects, blackbirds, squirrels chattering around its rush, drinking long borders where I am diminished, looking, feeling its skin. Farther there leaps the animal or sleek trout darting. Yes, I would like to cross into shadow gold everywhere now. Yes, it's true I was in the woods and walked halfway across, then stood above its cataract. The bridge pressed time and me into its name. This next poem is entitled Poem Beginning with a Line by Milosz, the famous Polish poet Czesław Milosz. The most beautiful bodies are like transparent glass. They are bodies of the selfless, are those newly dead. What appears transparent is really flame burning so brightly, it appears like glass. What you're looking through is the act of giving. one thing in life needed desperately given to another. Or perhaps life itself. The most beautiful bodies are not transparent, but sometimes the color of lead, like the elephant whom a child with some peanuts lifts by the trunk in his hand in the swirling dust, so that it appears he has lifted a monument or a city with all its pain. The bodies that seem transparent are made of an ice so pure it appears to be glass sweating, where you, desiring another, glimpse your own face that weighs nothing and is burning. Portraits. Mother came to visit today. We hadn't seen each other in years. Why didn't you call? I asked. Your windows are filthy, she said. I know, it's from the dust and rain. She stood outside. I stood in. And we cleaned each one that way, staring into each other's eyes, rubbing the white towel over our faces, rubbing away hours, years. This is what it was like when you were inside me, she said. What? I asked, though I understood. Afterwards, indoors, she smelled like snow melting. Holding hands, we stood by the picture window, gazing into the December sun, watching the pines in flame. It's a very short poem entitled The Heart. The faster we drove, the faster the leaves changed color. In storms, they would appear to repeat themselves, become a green, trembling fur against the violet horizon. The engine roared, while along that yellow corridor, her lips spoke faster words. When we arrived, the trees were bare all around that red cavern. Before it, we laid our shoes and names, then entered to be devoured. This poem is entitled The Death, and the title becomes part of the first line. The death of death. Is that not what we want? For a moment to foil it with flushed skin in the mud house? Or with a word wounding the air such that others stand around, surprised and forgetful? Now is not a time, but all times, each word says. In the perfect, long past world, cells cloned really lived forever. For though they died, all were the same. In a coma, he looked like a sleeping child. I pulled a comb through his hair. And think of it now, pausing, placing a comma. Left with words, what would you build? Something green? A kind of pier to walk out on? Angela showed me three black lab fetuses taken from a spay. In a test tube, you could see their heads, the protoplasmic dot of each dark nose, chasing ducks through the snow. This poem is entitled Shoes, and it refers to the death of Matthew Shepard, who was a gay man who was lured by purposefully by two other men in a bar in Laramie, Wyoming, and then taken out into the countryside, tied to a barbed wire fence, and brutally murdered. Shoes. They cover the human foot. From the old English, skoo, akin to the German Schuhe. From the Indo-European base Sku, to hide. The arch, heel and sole. The upper, tongue and lacing. Some wore wingtips, oxfords and loafers, while others sported walkers or sandals. As they left their offices and towns, as they left their offices and homes in that quaint mountain town. He was tied naked to a fence, then beaten. They stood on a ridge. Some, barefoot, lined their shoes along the edge. Others wore them on their hands, watching the sky. This is a short little poem entitled Gospel. He asked us to stand, then began to read. I am the living bread. If anyone eats of this bread, he will live forever. This bread is my flesh. And before he had finished, we were on our knees, eating it like dogs, panting as we ravenously chewed, tearing large chunks with teeth, flourishing smiles, our eyes intent, as our mouths till our breathing was a form of eating too. And the bread filled our lungs, till we weighed nothing, then wrote our names in spit, and were gone. This poem is entitled Spring. When I was 9, I began building the plane. She was old and had let her white hair grow out all winter. I moved her bed, the fuselage, from the living room out into the lawn. For wings, I attached both doors from her room. Perhaps you've heard the ing, ing, ing of the plane taking off, or felt its puff on your face as you wave, looking up towards the whirr and mountain's blanched glare, and feel something like the morning through which you wake, dumb, thirsty, and alone. This poem, Landscape with a Horse Named Popcorn, was featured today, oddly enough, on Poetry Daily. Landscape with a Horse Named Popcorn. The hummingbird hovers over bougainvillea, darting in and out of blossoms, as the bride throws her corset among laughter and waving hands, seeing you, glass in hand, sunlight piercing the punch bowl's crystal. I remember the horse, an Appaloosa, the white and gray markings like clouds, cumulus, one later on his grave, the 2x4 cross with name, above a swell of land that could bring a man to his knees or make him look up at fumbling shapes, cotton-fumed and slow. I can hear the screeching still. The colt had grabbed a turkey nesting in scrub oak and prancing, shook it in his mouth as we ran reaching toward black feathers, then the fine spray of blood, until beyond adrenaline, we began laughing, as laughing now, brushing confetti away, you hand the bride flowers, narcissi, their green throats pushing up from wet stones in a jar. I'm returning to the first part of the book now. And I'm going to read the title poem of the book, which is entitled Large White House Speaking. From morning to evening, the resolution of light through windows. We would like to, yes, we would like to go. We would like to stay, but friends are calling, summoning, waving. It's a man, woman, child. It's a man, woman, boy. It's a man, woman, young man. Hi, how are you? Yes, I'm fine, thank you. There's a dog, sofa, tables, chairs, ottoman, books, records, toys, pictures. A house is a pocket with many smaller pockets, rooms, closets, drawers. You are reaching now into the darkness, from morning to evening. The resolution of lights, the resolution of time. People are windows, lenses that focus emotion, the way a magnifying glass focuses light, and the bright points burst into flame. From morning to memory, yes, we would like to, yes, we would like to, yes, summon them back. Then love is that distance magnified by darkness. Why is it when I say now, you do not get closer, but shine like something smashed, luminous and singing, as the space grows larger. I remember when the back of his head fits snugly in my palm from morning till evening. Yes, we would like to, yes. Then it was hard to, yes, think of the distance from God.
You've been listening to Mark Irwin read from his latest collection, Large White House Speaking. For more information about Mark and all of his books, you can go to markirwinauthor.com, markirwinauthor.com. Now, with the couple of minutes we have left, I want to bring your attention to a very special event. This is the first evening of the Word Temple Arts and Lectures series, which will take place on Saturday, October 26th at 7 p.m. This is not a poetry event. This is a conversation between Susan Griffin and Judy Gron. Griffin, named by Utney Reader as one of the most important visionaries of the new millennium, is the author of Woman and Nature, A Chorus of Stones, The Private Life of War, co-editor of Transforming Terror, Remembering the Soul of the World, and many other books. Judy Gron is a poet and social theorist. She is the author of A Simple Revolution, Love Belongs to Those Who Do the Feeling, and many other books. The two women will take the stage and they will each read from their books, and then they will have a conversation with each other on stage before taking questions from the audience. That is Saturday, October 26th at 7 p.m. at the Sebastopol Center for the Arts, 282 South High Street in Sebastopol. For more information on this event, you can go to wordtemple.com. I want to thank my two guests tonight, Mark Irwin and Sydney Lee. If you have any questions or comments about tonight's program, please contact me at khastings@wordtemple.com. Thanks for listening.